Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Malala and Sajarty accept Nobel Peace Prize. And former Polish president says U.S. interrogated suspected terrorists in Poland. I'm Bob Doty in Washington. Pakistani education activist Malala Yousafzai and Indian child rights advocate Kailash Satyarthi made history Wednesday as they accepted this year's Nobel Peace Prize at a ceremony in Oslo, Norway. 17-year-old Malala is the youngest Nobel laureate, while Satyarthi is the first Indian-born Peace Prize winner. Speaking at the awards ceremony, Malala said it is time to take action to help children, not to pity them, so it becomes the last time that we see a child deprived of education. Satyarthi, who has worked to end child slavery, said his goal is for every child to be free to be a child. He added that there is no greater violence than to deny the dreams of children. The two are sharing the award's $1.1 million prize. Former Polish President Kwaśniewski says Poland let the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency run a secret prison on its territory, but he says Polish officials did not authorize harsh treatment or torture of the suspected terrorists at the site. In an interview Wednesday with a Warsaw radio station, Mr. Kwaśniewski said he urged then-U.S. President George W. Bush to end all U.S. intelligence efforts at the prison more than 10 years ago. This is the first time the former Polish president has publicly acknowledged the existence of the prison after denying it for years. It is believed the CIA ran the facility in Poland in 2002 and 2003. This is VOA News. A Palestinian cabinet minister has died after clashes with Israeli troops during a protest in the West Bank. Ziad Abu Ain died Wednesday shortly after the confrontation. Witnesses said Israeli troops fired tear gas at protesters and beat some of them with rifle butts. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called the incident a brutal attack and a barbaric act. Mr. Abbas pledged to take the necessary measures after an investigation. There was no immediate comment from Israel. Ukrainian soldiers and pro-Russian rebels are largely honoring a declared halt in hostilities for a second consecutive day in eastern Ukraine. Only sporadic gunfire was reported early Wednesday, 24 hours after both sides began observing the so-called Day of Silence. It is designed to encourage both sides to observe the wider ceasefire agreed to in September. If the guns remain silent, the parties plan to begin pulling back their heavy weaponry to form a buffer zone from the front line. Talks on a wider resolution to the conflict are expected to be held Friday in Belarus. A former top Chinese economic planning official has been convicted of bribery and sentenced to life in prison, becoming the latest high-profile figure to be brought down by China's anti-corruption campaign. The official Xinhua News Agency said Liu Tianan was found guilty of taking $5.8 million in bribes during his time as the deputy head of the National Development and Reform Commission, China's top economic planning body. The allegations against Liu first surfaced in December 2012 when a journalist at the Kaijing Investigative Magazine posted the stories on his microblog. Liu at first forcefully denied the charges, but at his trial in September, the 60-year-old was seen tearfully confessing to taking various bribes, including cash, a Porsche, and a luxury Beijing villa. Democratic and Republican leaders in the U.S. Congress have reached a deal on a $1.1 trillion spending bill that would fund the federal government through next year, except for the Department of Homeland Security, which is funded until February 27th. The spending package was finalized late Tuesday, just 2 days before the government's current spending authority expires. The United Nations Refugee Agency says the world needs to better focus on responding to the hundreds of thousands of people making risky sea journeys in search of asylum or migration. The agency says at least 348,000 people have tried to make sea crossings so far this year, a likely record with 4,272 deaths. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Ruhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
There's still 470,000 homicides around the world every year. This is actually a decrease from the year 2000 by 16%.
That's Dr. Itene Krug of the World Health Organization with some of the results of a new global report on violence prevention. Details coming up.
Also, today is Human Rights Day, and the International Rescue Committee calls for community leadership to fight the Ebola crisis in West Africa.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, today is Human Rights Day. This year's theme is Human Rights 365, to signify that every day is Human Rights Day. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says human rights are for everyone, no matter their class, opinions, or sexual orientation. He added that violations of rights are more than personal tragedies. They are alarm bells that may be warning of a much bigger crisis. On this Human Rights Day, the Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded. Pakistani education analyst Malala Yousafzai and Indian child rights advocate Kailash Satyarthi made history today as they accepted this year's Nobel Peace Prize at a ceremony in Oslo, Norway. 17-year-old Malala is the youngest Nobel laureate, while Satyarthi is the first Indian-born Peace Prize winner. The two are splitting the awards at $1.1 million. Satyarthi said his aim in life is for every child to be free to be a child, adding there is no greater violence than to deny the dreams of children. Malala has dedicated her life to promoting girls' rights to education. She was shot in the head by the Taliban on her school bus in 2012.
UN agencies have released a joint report today called the Global Status Report on Violence Prevention. It says homicide is the third leading cause of death for male between the ages of 15 and 44. It also says one in four children has been physically abused and one in three women have been the victim of physical violence. Dr. Itene Krug is director of the Department for Management of Non-Communicable Diseases, Disability Violence, and Injury Prevention at the World Health Organization. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua.
Well, we've just finished a big study looking at violence prevention efforts around the world. We've sent a questionnaire out to all countries, really, and 103 countries responded, representing 80% of the world population. What it shows is that there's still 470,000 homicides around the world every year. This is actually a decrease from the year 2000 by 16%, and an even bigger decrease in high-income countries. It's about almost 40%. However, we also looked at violence prevention programs around the world, and what we find is that, you know, we know what the best buys are, we know what works, but only one-third of countries are implementing large-scale initiatives to prevent violence, such as, you know, programs in schools to prevent bullying, programs to prevent the child maltreatment by having nurses visit houses, etc. Another piece of information we looked at is the existence of laws, and we looked at 12 key laws, which we found that most countries actually have them. However, they also report that they're not really being enacted, they're not really being implemented.
What's been the impact on women and children?
The impact on women and children is very big. We know that one in three women around the world are victims of violence by their partner or by strangers in terms of sexual violence. We know that one in four children around the world has been physically abused. That means already a huge proportion of the population. Violence, of course, we know causes injuries and deaths and disability. But it also has a very big impact on mental health. It has a big impact on sexual and reproductive health by, you know, transmission of HIV or unwanted pregnancies after rape. And it does change people's behavior. We know that people affected by violence are more likely to smoke, to abuse drugs and alcohol, to take on risky behaviors such as unsafe sex or unsafe driving. All of these have their own long-term consequences on health. So a large number of population is affected by violence, and the consequences on their health is huge.
Now, if so many countries have these laws in effect, any idea why so few are actually fully enforcing them?
Well, it's not always easy to enforce such laws, but there's also very often still tolerance around violence against women, tolerance around violence against children, and that's something we definitely have to change.
And how do you go about doing that in those countries?
I think we need to change our mindset and talk about it very openly and make sure that violence is considered as unacceptable, violence against any type of person, boys or girls, young or old. Because another finding of the report is that elder maltreatment is often one of the most neglected areas of violence. And we know that a large number of older people report having been abused. So it's a question of really changing the mindset and deciding violence is unacceptable. We're going to invest into preventing it by all possible means.
Dr. Itene Krug is the director of the Department for Management of Noncommunicable Diseases, Disability, Violence and Injury Prevention at the World Health Organization. From Geneva, he spoke to VOA's Jody Capua.
Coming up on 12 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Nigeria has turned to Russia to buy heavier weapons following a recent strain in relations with the United States. After the U.S. rejected a request for Cobra attack helicopters, Nigeria canceled a U.S. military training program linked to the fight against Boko Haram militants. Analysts now are weighing the effects of the arms deal with Russia. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Jennifer Cook of the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies follows U.S.-Nigeria relations.
In the broad sense, I think the relationships are good and enduring. But at this particular moment, there is a great deal of tension, particularly over the security relationship.
Cook is director of the CSIS's Africa program. Also watching developments in Nigeria is Ben Moores, senior analyst at the Defense and Security Analysis Organization, IHS Jane's 360.
I think the U.S. is still fully committed to supporting democracy in Nigeria in terms of a trading relationship, in terms of military equipment. I think it has changed somewhat with withdrawal of trainers, the training team from Nigeria.
Moore says there are several reasons why the U.S. would not sell Nigeria advanced weapons systems.
The advanced helicopters and fighter jets the U.S. has, they wouldn't want to go to Nigeria because that equipment could be passed on to a third party. And also selling fighter jets and attack helicopters to Nigeria doesn't perhaps solve the problem that Nigeria has when dealing with the insurgency. What you really need is a better motivated force, a more professional force, to deal with some of the social and cultural problems that exist in Nigeria.
Jennifer Cook says each side has a different perception of the situation.
Nigeria's perception that the U.S. is somehow abandoning Nigeria in its moment of need as it's threatened by Boko Haram and not providing the kind of security and military assistance that Nigeria feels it needs right now. For the United States, there's deep concern over Nigeria's response to Boko Haram, a very military-heavy response and one that has raised a lot of allegations about mass human rights abuses.
Rights groups say those abuses include the killing and detention of innocent civilians. Cook says the U.S. considers human rights an important issue in Nigeria.
The human rights standard is not just for moral reasons. It's that the U.S. has learned the hard way that human rights abuses and failing to engage communities really becomes a security setback over the long run as well.
But defense analyst Moore says U.S. concerns go beyond human rights when it comes to weapon sales and military training.
My understanding is that there were leaks or moles inside the Nigerian military who were leaking information to Boko Haram. They were leaking certain bits of information, training information, and perhaps information on the team itself.
Moores explains why Nigeria would turn to Russia for the types of weapons it could not get from the United States.
Russia is known to sell equipment at a relatively low cost. It's known to sell to pretty much anyone without any questions asked. It doesn't ask for any guarantees in terms of where the equipment could go or how the equipment's used. There's no oversight. They don't have to sign up to any agreements. Not only that, but Russia's able to supply equipment relatively quickly and supply equipment that is fairly easy for less technically capable militaries to get that equipment into the front line at a relatively fast pace.
What's more, he says, Russia may give Nigeria a $1 billion line of credit to buy the weapons. The IHS Jane's analyst says Nigeria has a long wish list of military hardware, including jet trainers, light to medium fighter jets, some tactical transports, and ground attack helicopters. Moore says Nigeria has agreed to buy some Russian Mi-35s and Mi-17s.
These are fairly older aircraft and quite expensive to run. So that's probably why the Nigerians would have wanted to go to America first.
Moores also says Russia is now training Nigerian special forces. Cook of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says the Nigeria-Russia relationship is one to watch.
Russia is willing. It has arms available to sell. It's willing to train. And it's early to tell, but one wonders if there's maybe a larger play by Russia in terms of winning new partners and poking a stick in the eye of the United States, for example. I think the Nigerian government right now is looking for help wherever it can get it.
Cook says it's easy to criticize Nigeria for alleged human rights abuses and corruption. However, she says it's important to understand the position that Nigeria is in.
I think there has to be this fundamental acknowledgement of what a difficult problem they're facing. When a group straps suicide bombs onto 14-year-olds or suicide bombers into mosques or dresses up as police and security forces and kidnaps hundreds of girls, the Nigerian government does not have the kind of training, the kind of equipment, the kind of command and control that the U.S. military has.
Cook says the U.S. should have a more positive and constructive dialogue with Nigeria. A lot of that, she says, has to do with diplomatic tone. The relationship between the U.S. and Nigeria has changed in another way, too. The U.S. used to buy a lot of Nigerian oil, but sales have dropped sharply as the United States has become much more energy independent. The U.S. itself has become a major exporter. Oil prices have plunged this year, and more declines are forecast for next year. That means a lot less money in Nigeria's coffers, as it does for Russia, also an oil exporter. Russia's economy has also been hit hard by economic sanctions due to its political and military moves against Ukraine. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Joe. And we have breaking news from Nigeria. Two explosions have rocked a marketplace in Nigeria's second largest city, Kano. Initial reports say two female suicide bombers set off the blast today at the Canton Quarry Market. At least four people are reported dead, with several others injured. Militant group Boko Haram is suspected in a string of attacks around Kano, including a deadly attack on Kano's central mosque late last month.
Almost 1 year after 2-year-old boy in Guinea died of Ebola, the first victim in the West Africa epidemic, the World Health Organization reports the virus has killed more than 6,000 people in West Africa. And today, the head of the World Health Organization says the outbreak is still running ahead of efforts to contain the spread of the virus. WHO Director General Margaret Chan says there has been some improvements in efforts to control the epidemic, but large numbers of cases are still being reported. Some have been harshly critical of the WHO for taking too long to declare a health emergency in the first place. Chan says the whole world failed to recognize the scope of the problem in the beginning. Chan says, with hindsight, there should have been a much more robust response.
Well, the International Rescue Committee, IRC, is calling for a different kind of army to combat the spread of Ebola in West Africa. The organization is calling on community leadership to be placed at the center of the response, particularly in Liberia and Sierra Leone. They say community leaders must be listened to and empowered to initiate solutions that work best for their communities. Emmanuel Darcourt is the senior health director for the IRC. He spoke with me about what needs to be done for communities to take the lead in solving extreme challenges such as the Ebola epidemic.
There needs to be several things for communities to really take the lead in fighting against Ebola. The first is that we have to find a cadre of people who are good middle people, intermediaries between the communities and the international and government response. So you need to find people who really know how to approach communities and who generate trust and who understand how communities work and are able to quickly understand cues and reach out to people.
What would be some examples of these types of people that you all are working with now in communities?
Some of them are working for NGOs, such as the IRC. Some of them are working for government, and some of them are working independently and like doing that. And some are men, some are women, some are actually quite shy, some of them are very much public figures, very comfortable in their role. That's a lot of very different kind of people. But what they have in common is that they are good listeners, and they're not thinking primarily about themselves. They have a real respect and understanding of just how powerful communities are and how able they are. So that rather than viewing them as sort of victims and as people who have little education or who are isolated from the world, they view them as incredibly effective people. And that's a hard thing to learn, that understanding of communities as powerful, effective entities rather than victims. So a characteristic of effective community workers is that they are able to deliver so that the community sees that this communication, this partnership they're having is actually going to come through for them.
You've explained how important it is to really be a good listener as a community leader and to be able to take action after listening. How can this quality be used between communities, communities interacting with each other?
Well, very, very important. And I think a big part of it is, in terms of applying it and spreading that, is that it can't be completely improvised. We've found that the people who do this best are people who have been doing it for 10, 15, 20 years. Often you'll find that the people who are doing best and who are doing the best work in Ebola have actually been doing good work for a long time and have long understood how communities are working.
Your organization has pledged $500,000 for community empowerment in both Liberia and Sierra Leone. How will this money be used?
We're going to use this money in a variety of ways, but principally we are going to use it to develop a group of people in Liberia as well as in Sierra Leone who are already doing work, and we're going to make sure that they have the resources they need to do that work better. So we're not going to invent a new infrastructure or have people come in cold who've never done this kind of work, and then we're suddenly going to train them. We're going to find the people who are already doing this work, and we are already doing that. So we're finding the people who do this work and making sure that they have the logistical support so that, for example, if they need a car or a motorcycle to take them from one village to another, they have that car or that motorcycle. If they need, you know, something as simple as, you know, a few sodas, because that's a part of holding a meeting of when you call a meeting in West Africa, you have to provide just a few refreshments or a little food for participants, and that they're able to do that. These sound like such simple things, but these are the complaints we've been hearing from people. People have been doing the best work against Ebola that they don't even have the most basic support. We're also going to make sure they have things like rain gear so that, you know, as they do this work in the tail end of the rainy season, they don't have to be held back by simple material things like that. But the important thing for us is that we're not just committing these $500,000. We have tens of millions of dollars that we're dedicating to the fight against Ebola. And every one of those dollars is spent with the community in mind.
Okay. That was Emmanuel Darcourt. He's the senior health director for the IRC. He spoke with me from New York City.
Mm-hmm.
A new study finds that South Africa's path to racial and social reconciliation is not only a long one, but one with several unexpected twists and turns. This year's report from the Institute for Justice and Reconciliation shows reconciliation is happening, but warned of the danger of forgetting the nation's racist past. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to the report's lead author and has this story from Johannesburg.
The Institute for Justice and Reconciliation says South Africans are more often blurring race lines when it comes to trusting their fellow man, 20 years after the end of the racist system of apartheid. The report finds trust between South Africans of different races has consistently risen in the past decade. That is illustrated by the discovery that black South Africans trust their political leaders, who are usually also black, less than ever. That sentiment is no doubt bolstered by a seemingly never-ending procession of high-level corruption scandals. But IJC project leader Kim Whale says not all the news is positive, and research shows that in 2013, South Africans are about 10% less likely to agree that apartheid was a crime against humanity than they were just a decade earlier. The 2002 treaty establishing the International Criminal Court classified apartheid a crime against humanity. That loss of awareness of a widely held truth, she says, should be a concern.
It's worrying because if we don't keep this memory alive, then we won't be tuned into addressing its legacy in the present, and unfortunately its legacy still really does remain with us.
She is referring to the wide economic disparities that still fall along race lines. The divisions are easy to see even to a casual observer in Johannesburg, the nation's economic hub. On one street corner in a trendy neighborhood filled with hip coffee shops, bookstores, restaurants, and patrons of all races, VOA News finds race is still a sensitive topic. Many passersby refuse to share their views on race. Others ask that we stick to their first names only. Leslie, a 23-year-old black man, works on the streets sometimes as a car guard. The rest of the time, he says, he is unemployed. But he does not see his situation as a legacy of apartheid and does not really remember it. When asked about the nation's historical inequalities, he came up blank.
94. 99, I was in grade 1. So you see, my brain was not older to remember some things that they've been past.
Animator Paul Meyer, who is 40 and has three adopted children of a different race, says he is trying to raise his children in a land of equality and opportunity. But he says reconciliation is not happening everywhere.
I think it's a mixed bag, and I think you'll get different answers depending on who you speak to. I think there's definitely movement in both directions.
Pila Molefe, a 41-year-old domestic worker, said she thinks part of the divisions are caused by the inability of the government to crack down on crime.
What's stopping us is that we didn't reconcile yet. And we can't forgive each other. And there is a lot of things that are happening now that makes us angry each and every day, like corruption and robbery and stealing, all those things.
The IJC report says the nation's poor, who are almost all black, have been largely excluded from racial integration. Even the simple opportunity to socialize with people of other races narrows as income levels decrease. Whale says South Africans need to tear down their walls, first the psychological ones, and then maybe some actual ones that abound around homes and buildings as part of extensive security measures in a crime-laden country.
So building awareness is the first step, and then there's structural transformation that requires the fact that South Africa still often looks very similarly to how it used to look during apartheid is a problem, and we need to readdress the way our cities are structured so that the poor are excluded and the poor remain black. So there are real structural changes that are required, but then also changes in terms of how ordinary South Africans understand racism and the operation of racism in society.
But she says South Africa has come a long way in just 20 years, though it has a long way to go. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Today is Human Rights Day. Nigeria turns to Russia to buy heavier weapons following a recent strain in relations with the United States. And the WHO reports the Ebola virus has killed more than 6,000 people in West Africa. Coming up, we'll have music from Uganda. And in our feature segment, President Obama's African grandmother is in the United States to raise money for a school and hospital in Kenya. I'm Kim Lewis with Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand coming up we'll hear from a basketball superstar.
That's right, Kim. We're going to hear from that basketball superstar a little later in the program. But first, a big international club football tournament is kicking off this evening. Joining us once again on the Voice of America from Johannesburg to tell us about it is our African football guru, David Legg. Good evening, David.
Good evening, Sonny, and good evening to all the football lovers around the continent.
David, the FIFA Club World Cup kicks off in just a few hours in Rabat, Morocco. How about a preview for our VOA football fans?
Because the tournament is in Morocco, Africa will have two representatives. Margaret Tetouan, they're the Moroccan champions. There's a playoff before we get to the quarterfinals, and they'll play Auckland City of New Zealand. Auckland City are hardy annuals when it comes to this competition, but they've yet to taste victory. On home soil in Rabat, you would certainly fancy Tetouan, the Moroccan champions, to triumph. And if they do, Sonny, it sets up an interesting quarterfinal because they will play Entente Setif of Algeria, the CAF Champions League winners. So we have, in a sense, a North African derby in the quarterfinals. And although some of our listeners might think that that's disappointing and that one African team will be knocked out, I'm looking at it from the other point of view, and that is that one African team will be guaranteed a place in the semifinals. And whichever African team, assuming it is Setif or Tetouan, does get through, they will have the slightly easier of the semifinals in that they will play the Argentinians, San Lorenzo, rather than the star-saturated Real Madrid of Spain. Now, that's to show absolutely no disrespect to San Lorenzo. Coming from Argentina and champions of South America, they must be a really good team. But I doubt they're as good as Real Madrid, who have been in sublime form of late, both in the Spanish La Liga and also in the UEFA Champions League. And, of course, last year, after some disappointments in this competition for Africa, Raja Casablanca got all the way to the final. They beat the Brazilians Internacional in the semifinals and then lost out to Bayern Munich of Germany 2-0 in the decider. But they were far from disgraced. Let's keep our fingers crossed, Sonny, that the same can happen again. Just a reminder to all our listeners, Tetouan will play Auckland City of New Zealand. And if the Moroccans qualify, they will play Entente Setif of Algeria in the quarterfinals, and the winners of that will play San Lorenzo of Argentina in the semifinals.
David, the club with the proudest pedigree of any African team, Al Ahly of Egypt, lifted a record-extending 19th African Cup. They lifted the Confederation Cup at home in Cairo. Your thoughts on Al Ahly, David?
Yes, Sonny, and they left it so late. 6 minutes into stoppage time, to be exact, when Imad Mateeb, the veteran striker, headed the only goal of the game. 1-0 then to Ahly. They had lost the first leg 2-1 in Abidjan, so it finished 2-2 on aggregate, but Ahly won the competition on the away goal rule. But it was really cruel, Sonny, for Siwe Sport of Ivory Coast. Although they were the architects of their own downfall, they had several great chances in both halves to score goals. It would not have been an exaggeration to say they should have been two goals ahead going into stoppage time, but they failed to take their chances. A lack of composure, blazing over shots that at the very least should have been on target. And then Atley, as always, so resilient, great fighters, right at the death. Walid Solomon with a cross. Matib somehow found himself unmarked deep inside the six-yard box, and his header gave the Ivorian goalkeeper no chance. But this was a different Atley, Sonny, from the one of a decade ago. Then they used to crush opposition in Cairo. They would always win these sort of matches by 3, 4, even 5 goals. But this time they really had to dig deep into their resources. For, as you said, a record-extending 19th CAF title. And that total of 19 is made up of 8 in the CAF Champions League. This was their first in the Confederation Cup. They've won the CAF Super Cup 6 times. And they've also won the now-defunct African Cup Winners' Cup 4 times. And for their coach, also a little bit of history, Jean Carlos Garrido, he becomes the first Spaniard to win a CAF club title. Next season, Sonny, Atley will be back in the CAF Champions League, where we're most familiar with them playing. And Garrido, no doubt, will be hoping to build on this CAF Confederation Cup success. I've had quite a few emails from listeners to the Sunny Side of Sport asking me when the draws will take place. I got in touch with Junior Binyam. He's the media director at the Confederation of African Football. And he tells me that the draws will be made and also will be announced on Monday, December the 22nd, so just before the start of the festive season. We'll have the draws for the preliminary, first and second rounds of both the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederation Cup.
David, as Al Ahly was lifting the CAF Confederation Cup, the Los Angeles Galaxy, playing at home in Southern California, lifted a record 5th MLS Cup, the trophy awarded to the Major League Soccer champion. It marked a successful championship exit for longtime Galaxy star Landon Donovan, also starred for the USA national team. Your thoughts about Donovan, David, and his legacy with U.S. soccer?
Yeah, I'm a great fan of his, Sonny, because I think he was a very great sportsman as well as a very good footballer. I had the privilege, as had many South Africans, of watching him a lot on the TV screens, playing for various clubs in the English Premier League. He always impressed me, and what I liked about him is he was a really thorough sportsman, and I think he will go down certainly as one of the greatest, if not, in some people's opinion, the greatest American-born footballer who has graced the football field. And the U.S. gave me one of my biggest thrills in football this year when they played in the World Cup. Some really sterling performances by the team before they made that last 16 exit.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Ed Kowalski for the Classic Rock Show, where each week we spotlight the great album rock and roll of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Wednesday at 21 hours Universal Time. Join me for the Classic Rock Show, 21 hours Universal Time Wednesdays on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
If you were to talk to us from the deepest bitter part of the bottom of your heart... Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
And my Voice of America colleague, Shaka Sali, will be waiting for you Wednesday night at 18:30 UTC with another edition of Straight Talk Africa. In more African football news, 2015 Nations Cup host Equatorial Guinea has suffered a setback in its preparations for next month's tournament, as we hear now from our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Chad surprised hosts Equatorial Guinea 2-1 in the semifinals at the Central Africa Economic and Monetary Community CEMAC Cup in Bata on Tuesday. The Republic of Congo edged Cameroon 2-1 in the capital Malabo to book their place in Saturday's final. The CEMAC Cup is an annual regional tournament featuring national teams made up of home-based players from Cameroon, Central African Republic, Chad, the Republic of Congo, Equatorial Guinea, and Gabon. In Tanzania, Burundi pipped hosts Tanzania 2-1 in a friendly match played in Dar es Salaam on Tuesday. The encounter was part of Tanzania's 53rd independence celebration. This is Burundi's third triumph over Tanzania in as many matches this year. In the earlier encounters, Burundi prevailed with scores of 3-0 and 2-0. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Because this is Africa. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited. Because
this is Africa. This time for Africa.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcast. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
In pro basketball news, LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers scored their eighth consecutive victory Tuesday night, rallying to beat the visiting Toronto Raptors 105-101. LeBron once again led the way, scoring 35 points, including 10 in the fourth quarter. Hey, LeBron, what were the keys to victory?
Just dug down defensively. Delly and Tristan and Deion coming off the bench, their energy helped us out a lot tonight. The first home game off a road trip is always tough. And I told the guys at halftime, we're not tired. Don't let the mental fatigue or whatever you're thinking about get us off track of what we're trying to do. And we came out in the second half, especially in the fourth quarter, and defended like we've been doing over the streak.
Our VOA basketball fans will remember LeBron James returned to the Cleveland Cavaliers in the offseason after winning two NBA championships with the Miami Heat. LeBron says the Cavaliers have a young team and they still have a lot of work to do if they're going to win the NBA title. In Tuesday night's other NBA results, the Portland Trail Blazers topped the Detroit Pistons 98-86. The Memphis Grizzlies beat the Dallas Mavericks 114-105. The New Orleans Pelicans defeated the New York Knicks 104-93. The Oklahoma City Thunder stormed past the Milwaukee Bucks 114-101. In a red-hot matchup, the Miami Heat scorched the Phoenix Suns 103-97. The Utah Jazz beat the defending NBA champion San Antonio Spurs 100-96. And Kobe Bryant and the Los Angeles Lakers beat their California state rival, the Sacramento Kings, 98-95. Kobe was clutch at the end of the contest, scoring 9 of his 32 points in the final 3 minutes and 15 seconds of the game. Now in the twilight of what surely will be a Hall of Fame basketball career, Kobe is leading the NBA in scoring, averaging 25.5 points per game. And a quick shout-out for DeMarcus Cousins of the Sacramento Kings. He's leading the NBA in rebounding right now at 12.6 per game. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, President Obama's African grandmother in the United States to raise money for a school and hospital in Kenya. And next, migrants, mostly from Africa, continue to make the deadly Mediterranean Sea crossing from North Africa to Europe. But first, some music. Here is Blue 3 of Uganda with Together.
I want to give you the ring, let it be you to give me the love that I need. You know what I mean, girl, where you in, I mean, wanting something me, you know. Let me be the one to take you over, it's all, yeah. Let me be the one to take you over, it's all, yeah.
Luthri of Uganda with Together.
President Obama's African grandmother recently came to the United States to raise money for a $12 million school and hospital center in Kogelo, Kenya. It's the birthplace of the president's father. Sarah Obama was also recognized for her decades of work serving poor Kenyans.
The only surviving grandparent of U.S. President Barack Obama, 94-year-old Mama Sarah Obama, as she prefers to be called, is visiting the United States from Kenya. Education is her chief cause, so a visit to a New York City school was on the itinerary. She spoke to the children through her interpreter.
If you work hard in school, so you can be great.
As a video made by her foundation shows, Mama Sarah Obama, who was a stepmother to Mr. Obama's father, Barack Obama Sr., has long worked to help poor widows and orphans in Kenya. She told a UN audience that as a girl, she was never even taught to read.
She said she never went to school. She was not an education, but she loves education. So that's why all her kids, she made them go to school, even Barack Obama Sr. Because when they learn, that's when they can be self-sufficient. They can help themselves. That's why she wants every child to study, not just hers. That's why she's taking up all these orphans.
Mama Sarah Obama received a Women's Entrepreneurship Day Award at the UN for her foundation, which is planning to build a school campus and hospital in her Kogelo, Kenya community. The foundation says so far it has raised nearly half of the $250,000 needed for the first building, an early childhood education center. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
The International Organization for Migration says thousands of migrants, mostly from Africa, continue to make the deadly Mediterranean Sea crossing from North Africa to Europe. The group says hundreds have been rescued in recent days from boats that have capsized and some have died. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration says more than 161,000 migrants have arrived safely in Italy since the beginning of this year. Many others were not so lucky. At least 3,200 have gone missing at sea and are presumed drowned. In November alone, more than 8,000 people have been rescued at sea. More than 5,000 migrants arrived in Italy in the last 10 days after being rescued by the ships plying waters in the Channel of Sicily after their fragile smugglers' boats had capsized. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says desperation pushes the migrants to make this dangerous journey despite the terrible risks.
This time of year, the waters are getting increasingly perilous, very wintry conditions, and yet the amount of people crossing doesn't seem to be going down significantly. But we note that most of the people being rescued in these past few weeks are sub-Saharan Africans from Gambia, Mali, Senegal, Nigeria, and Ghana. Although our team reported 575 Syrians came ashore this week.
The Italian government plans to close its Mare Nostrum Sea rescue mission by the end of the year. That operation, which has saved the lives of more than 100,000 migrants, is being replaced by a European Union operation called Triton. Its mission is limited to controlling the borders and carrying out search and rescue operations if necessary. Critics of Mare Nostrum argue the patrols encourage migrants to make the dangerous sea journeys. The IOM disagrees. Millman says the agency believes people are fleeing their home countries because of the terrible conditions that exist.
Either part of the large population of 200,000 to 300,000 overseas workers who are stranded in Libya and therefore subject to exploitation and forced, coerced transit across the Mediterranean by criminal groups, or it's people continuing to flee places of strife and taking the same trans-Sahara routes to Libya. I think it's probably a mixture of both, but we expect that population to continue to feel pressured and under threat in Libya, and that's going to continue to fuel the option to get on these boats.
IOM says it does not know what impact the end of Mare Nostrum will have on life-saving operations carried out at sea. But agency officials say the Mediterranean still needs to be patrolled. Otherwise, they say, many lives will be put in danger. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
With the United States leading the way, the international community's response to the Ebola fever epidemic gripping West Africa has slowed the disease's spread in hard-hit Liberia. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control, working closely with Liberian health officials, found that infection rates are beginning to fall, particularly in urban areas. Serious challenges remain, however, and hotspots of Ebola transmission remain in several counties. We have been helping fight the Ebola outbreak since soon after the first cases were reported in March. In early November, as part of our whole-of-government response to the crisis, we opened a special medical unit near the capital, Monrovia, to provide care to any healthcare workers who become infected while treating patients. Built by the U.S. Defense Department and manned by U.S. Public Health Service staff, the Monrovia Medical Unit is a 25-bed field hospital and has admitted 16 patients thus far. To build on this effort, a U.S. delegation traveled to Liberia on December 2nd to review the progress of Ebola response efforts in the country and to learn what more needs to be done. Led by Assistant Secretary of State Linda Thomas-Greenfield, a former U.S. ambassador to Liberia, the group met with the U.S. and U.N. missions, as well as international medical staff who are serving the people of Liberia during this global health crisis. The delegation also met with Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to underscore our nation's continued commitment to Liberia and to explore avenues that will accelerate its economic, political, and social recovery after the crisis. The United States has deep, historic ties to Liberia and has long worked with its government to move it out of its post-conflict status towards sustainable development. Since the end of the conflict in 2003, we have invested more than $2 billion toward rebuilding Liberia and improving the lives of its people. The Ebola outbreak is a severe blow to Liberia's progress, one that we are determined to help it overcome.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Happening Africa. This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.